Well, again, good morning. Welcome, Santa Barbara Community Church. Good to be together here this morning. As you already heard, my name is Benji, and I serve as one of two lead pastors in this church. And if you're really new to our church within, like, say, the last 3 months, you may not know that, but Mike Wilbanks is back, and I'm thrilled. Mike is here, and he's sitting right there, and he is so excited because he's been saving all the hugs that I didn't give you this summer, and he's ready. So find him afterwards. Well, this morning we will be, as you can see on the screen, continuing in our time in Romans chapter 8. So if you have your Bible, you can open it there. We are actually nearing the end of our time in Romans 8. We have today and then two more Sundays. And then on August 30th, we have our fall kickoff. And on that day, we will turn our attention, as we do every year, to our annual look at church life, re-examining the kind of church we want to be together. I hope you've enjoyed our time in Romans 8. I really have. I've been challenged and encouraged and comforted by these passages. In this marvelous chapter, Paul has continually placed the gospel's beauty and the world's brokenness side by side. And he has reminded us of both the heights of glory and the depths of groaning. And in holding nothing back, Paul has painted a picture of a truly healing God at work in the midst of a truly hurting world. And today we are going to get another critical addition to this picture. So we are going to just jump right into it. Romans chapter 8. If you're able, would you please stand to honor the reading of God's word? We're going to be in Romans 8, beginning in verse 28. I'm reading from the NIV, but follow along in whatever translation you have open in front of you. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. Church, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may return to your seats. Now, I know some of you are thinking, wow, that was a really short passage. No wonder it's taken you all summer to get through this chapter. You could have read a little more. But I'm wondering how many of you are familiar with the concept of a clown car. They were common at circuses starting in the 1950s, and a car will pull out into center ring, and out of one small vehicle would come a steady stream of clowns, seemingly stretching the limits of physics and how many people could fit in such a small space. I think that these three short verses may just be the clown car of Romans 8. And I say that not because they're not to be taken seriously, but because these few verses, these three verses that we just read, they feature a nearly unbelievable amount of content to consider. So I start with that because it's likely that as we read, there was something or other that caught your attention as the various themes and topics poured out of these verses. And there is actually not enough time to get into every possible topic, nor to do them justice. So I will do my best to help us dive into what I believe is at the heart of Paul's message in these three short verses, densely packed as they are. So fair warning, there is a lot of Greek vocabulary and grammar ahead. I'm super excited. You didn't respond, which means you're not, but that's where we're going anyway, because it's in my notes, and that's all I got. So here we go. Let's start with the promise. Romans 8:28, it's one of the most well-loved verses in the scriptures. It's the kind of promise that makes its way onto t-shirts and coffee mugs and candles and wall hangings and somehow or other a Morse code bracelet. I'm not totally sure how that one works. Like, do you like tap it? It doesn't make sense to me. But it's not difficult to see the appeal of this verse, right? But I think it's worth asking, what is the verse actually saying? That is, what is the actual promise here? Is it the one found on the coffee mug, all things work together for good? Or is it the one on the wall hanging, that in all things God works for the good? Because those are two different promises. Is Paul insisting that if you're a Christian, all things somehow magically become good? Or is he insisting that God works in all things toward a greater good? So today we're going to talk both grammar and biblical theology. I know it's hard to contain your anticipation, but let's start with the grammar. All right, students in the room, most of you are right down here. Hello, 5th through 12th graders. Yeah. So today is August 9th, which means soon you're going back to school. Oh. Here's the thing. I know some of you might have a different relationship with school. You're not super excited, whatever. You have been in school more recently than most of the rest of the room. So they're going to need your help for a hot moment, because you probably took English composition more recently than they did. So when you're constructing a basic sentence in English, students, what's the order? Yeah, no, subject, verb, object. Yes, Tegan, good work. Subject, verb, object. The rest of you, school's right around the corner. Your teachers are ready to reorient you to the things you need to know. So here's the thing. That's the case in English, but in Greek, things aren't quite so straightforward, because determining the subject of a sentence, it's not a matter of word order. It is a matter of conjugated case endings, which is super nerdy terminology to say that each Greek word has a root. And the way that the word gets ended has different endings. That tells you how that word is functioning. You can put a bunch of possible different endings on the root, and then you learn how it's working in the sentence. It also means that the Greek words in our Bibles don't always appear in the order an English speaker might expect to find them. And Romans 8:28 is a perfect example. Because if we were to translate the Greek as literally as possible into English, it would read this: "We know, and for the loved ones by God, all things works to good, according to purpose called those who called who are." I can't even read it. So in addition to looking like Yoda may have written it, this exercise highlights for us the challenge in interpreting this verse. And at the heart of that difficulty is this one question: who or what is the subject of the verb works? Is it God who works all things toward good, or is it that all things work together for good? And now I know it may seem like I'm making a big deal out of a small point of grammar, but I believe the difference actually really matters. So I'm going to put my cards on the table. Here we go. I believe that the best reading of this verse has God as the subject of the verb, meaning that the Christian faith does not suppose that things will somehow work themselves out on their own, but that there is a God whose goodness and power assure us that all things can be used for good ends. And this is an important reminder in the broader context of Romans 8. The broader context of Romans 8 suggests that we are not meant to read verse 28 as a promise that all things are somehow good and will sort themselves out, because from verse 17 on, Paul has been tightly focused on the reality of suffering, both in our individual lives and throughout creation. Paul has highlighted the common experience of suffering, of groaning, of experiencing our weakness. Both Ken and James helped us consider these themes the past couple of weeks, and if you missed either sermon, I'd recommend you track it down and listen. They were insightful and comforting and encouraging. Friends, Christians do not go through life responding to obviously hard things with false positivity, belting the anthem of the Lego movie, "Everything is awesome." Instead, Christians can go through life with the honest confession that suffering is truly suffering. Hardship is truly hardship. We don't slap a happy face on suffering, but we also don't enthrone it. Because Paul makes clear in verse 28 that even in our suffering, God is on the throne. God is the subject of the sentence. In all things, God is both in control and at work. And Paul claims he's at work for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Which brings us to our second key point here this morning. Let's talk about the purpose. Now, those of a certain vintage in the room will likely have little trouble completing this phrase: do you know that God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life? That is true. Well done. This is the first of what are known as the four spiritual laws. They were made popular by the organization known as Crew. And God has seen fit to use this opening question to bring many into his family, since they were first used by Bill Bright at UCLA in 1952. Now, I want you to know, there's nothing wrong with this opening question if you're about to share the gospel, but I do think it requires a little scriptural rounding out in ways highlighted by our passage here this morning. Because left to ourselves, many of us would hear this question, do you know that God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life? And we would respond, of course he does. What's not to love? Also, coincidentally, I have a wonderful plan for my life, so I'll compare notes with him. Maybe he'll sign off. So imagine our surprise to discover that Paul is clear about God's purpose, a purpose we might not have elected for ourselves, and it's one that's found in a tiny Greek word. Verse 29 begins with the Greek word gar. It's so fun to say. Try it. Gar. Yeah. Sounds like a pirate, but it's actually not. What it is it's a conjunction. And as any child of the 80s knows, when we reach conjunction junction, we have one question. What's your function? Yes. So gar has a use of ranges in the New Testament. But the most common use is an explanatory conjunction, meaning that it functions to introduce material that illuminates or further elaborates on what has come before. Gar is most often translated as for, but can also be translated as because or namely. So now we're better prepared to grasp Paul's thought when he says, in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. And then we wonder, well, what is that purpose? He says, namely, those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. Meaning that verse 29 both defines good and explains God's ultimate purpose for those who love him. Elizabeth Elliot, in her book, Suffering is Never for Nothing, she names one challenge that we face when we're attempting to reconcile the reality of suffering with the reality of God's goodness. And she writes this, answering the question depends upon our definition of good. An ancient man thought of goodness in moral terms. Modern man equates goodness with happiness. If it ain't fun, it ain't good. And I think most of the advertising we see would confirm her assessment. Yet in our passage, Paul defines good, and he defines it as being conformed to the image of the Son. And with this phrase, Paul widens the scope of redemption. He ushers each of us into something much bigger and much more ancient than merely personal salvation. So let's do a little biblical theology. In the opening chapter of the scriptures, we discover the story of God's good creative work. And at the pinnacle of that creation, we read this, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish and the sea and the birds and the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. The original readers would have seen in these verses echoes of a cultural practice that was familiar in their world. In his commentary on Genesis, Tremper Longman says this, it seems reasonable to understand the image of God on analogy with the practice of ancient Near Eastern kings setting up images of themselves throughout their realm. Like a statue reflects the presence and power and authority of a king, so human beings reflect the glory of God. Genesis 1 ends with this pinnacle. Humans are created in the image of God in order to bring his image throughout his realm, which is everything. And yet, you may recall that a short two chapters later, the man and the woman, they use their divinely given freedom to launch a rebellion against the good creator God and against his rule. And though the divine image remains intact for all humans after them, none of us has been able to perfectly fulfill this original calling of Genesis 1. And it's a calling that was originally written in Hebrew, as the Old Testament scriptures were, but that eventually made its way into Greek. So the Greek translation of the Old Testament is known as the Septuagint. It originated as early as the 3rd century BC, and after Alexander the Great conquered much of the Mediterranean world, it became a really important way for Greek-speaking Jews to stay connected to the story of their faith. Unsurprisingly, it was also the primary Bible for the Greek-speaking early church. So why does this matter for what we're reading in Romans 8? Well, in the Septuagint, Genesis 1:26 and 27 uses the term iconos for the word image. You can hear our English word icon in there, which is the same term that Paul uses when writing this to the early Colossian Christians. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. And wouldn't you know, that's the same term he uses here in Romans 8:29. So let's put it all together. These three uses of iconos, they lead to this dramatic and unmistakable conclusion. Humanity's original purpose in creation, to perfectly represent the Creator God as his iconos, is finally and perfectly fulfilled through Jesus, the true and perfect iconos. And now, the children of God are being conformed to his iconos so that Jesus would be the first of a family of siblings who are finally doing what we were always meant to do. This God-reflecting life, Paul says, this is not a bonus to salvation. It is directly and inseparably connected to the redeeming work of Christ and God's ultimate purpose. So we read in 1 John 3, for example, "See what great love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Dear friends, now we are children of God. And what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him. For we shall see him as he is." From the garden to the new creation, the story of God's purpose for humanity is simply as big as it gets. And to put Romans 8:29 into its surrounding context once again, Paul says this is a purpose that uniquely plays out in suffering. Paul portrays suffering as a means of Christiformity, which is likely not a word that's part of your day-to-day vocabulary. My spell check didn't like it this week either, but it's a good single word to capture the phrase conformed to the image of the Son. Christiformity is a process that Paul insists is uniquely propelled by suffering. Now, some have suggested that the promise of Romans 8:28 somehow obligates God to make all the jigsaw pieces of life fit so they create a picture that's marked by ease and comfort. That God will play the role of alchemist who turns suffering into jubilation. Now, sometimes he does that, but not typically. More often, suffering is truly suffering. But even when that's true, suffering is never final and never outside of God's ultimate purpose for his people. Tim Keller put it this way: Paul is not promising Christians an easier, more comfortable life. He is not saying that Christians will have a higher percentage of pleasant over unpleasant circumstances than unbelievers. Rather, Paul says that all things, the same basic range of good and bad things that happen to all people, with the addition of the suffering that comes from following a suffering king, are used by God in our hearts so that we are taught, humbled, and refined into the likeness of Christ. So, funny things happen when you're preparing to teach on a passage like this one. Because wouldn't you know that God might just gently and sometimes obviously bring along things in your week to test how much you believe that all things can make you more like Jesus? And I found myself thinking multiple times this week, okay, how could this make me more like Jesus? How could this make me more like Jesus? I was thinking that as recently as this morning, when I got up to make these slides and thought I was done and the program crashed. And I thought, okay, I don't really have time to remake them, but I'll remake them and everything's going to be fine until I hit every single red light on Cathedral Oaks. And I thought, I do not actually have time for this making me more like Jesus. And as I look around this room, I know there are stories of pain and suffering far more significant than red lights. But this passage insists that whether highs or lows, whether monumental or mundane, all things come our way for the purpose of conforming us into the image of Christ. But this passage also contains an important but easily overlooked invitation. The partnership. Let's talk about it. In verse 28, we read this, "And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." All right, let's talk more Greek vocab. I'm so excited. If you were to pick up a set of Greek vocabulary flashcards and come across the English word work, the Greek term on the other side will be ergon. That is the noun. Ergon also forms the root of the verb to work, ergodzomai, which is so fun to say, meaning to work or to labor. Now, these are the most common noun and verb for the concepts of work in the New Testament. So it's not surprising that ergon forms the root of the word that Paul uses in our verse, but he's not using exactly the same term. Instead, the word that Paul uses here is sunergeo. Sunergeo. You can see the root ergon in there, but the prefix sun in Greek means with or together. The verb sunergeo appears 5 times in the New Testament, and each time it describes a deep partnership. So putting this together with what we've already considered, I think it's terribly unlikely that God is partnering with all things to make them good for those who love him. That interpretation leaves us with a God who is reactive to the events of our lives, on his heels, and somehow left to respond. Instead, as New Testament scholar N.T. Wright argues in his book, Into the Heart of Romans, I believe the better understanding of this verse is this, that God works all things together for good with those who love him. So by carefully unpacking the meaning of all the Greek terms, he argues that God is in fact partnering with his beloved children to achieve his ultimate purpose of seeing them conformed to the image of Christ. And along the way, he acknowledges that his reading may set off some Reformation alarm bells. Maybe it already has for you, but he also insists it shouldn't. He says, Protestant theologians have always, quite rightly, worried about synergism. That is, the idea that people get saved as the result of a combined effort from God on the one hand and the believer on the other. In classic synergism, God does his bit, we do ours, and together we accomplish salvation. But the point is that here, as in the other places he uses the word, Paul is not, after all, speaking about how salvation is accomplished. The gospel-shaped call of God to human beings is not, in this passage, a matter of rescuing them from sin and death, though, of course, it has that effect as well. It's about being called for a purpose that works not just for them, but through them. So now we are looking at a passage that tells us that no matter what comes our way in life, God is going to use it for our ultimate good. That is to help form us more and more into the image of Christ. But he is not going to force Christ-likeness on us. Rather, it comes through our own willing cooperation with his Spirit within us. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground, I know, but we're not done. So, the process. Some of you have been looking at the clock and thinking to yourself, man, he's been talking for a long time already. When is he just going to get to predestination? That's kind of like the only thing that caught my attention here. Well, thanks for staying the course and prepare to be disappointed because, yes, Paul used the term predestination here. And yes, I believe that the Bible teaches the doctrine of election, both here and elsewhere in the scriptures. And yes, there is a way to use this passage to teach that important doctrine. But I don't think that's Paul's main purpose here, so I haven't made it mine either. Again, hear me. Instead of emailing me, hear me. I believe in election, and I believe the Bible teaches it. And while I believe that Paul references it here, I think he does so in service of a bigger purpose. That is, to reassure all of his readers in first century Rome or 21st century Santa Barbara that the promises of verses 28 and 29 are guaranteed, not by our own imperfect efforts, but by God's character and his promises. Those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. Again, God is the subject of each and every one of those verbs, which means that all that we've just considered about our participation, our cooperation, and our own sanctification, it's now an invitation, not a heavy obligation. Even as these verses invite our participation in the work of being conformed to the image of God, God is not keeping score of our efforts to determine whether we're truly in the family or not. God predestines, God calls, God justifies, and God glorifies. And all along the way, He invites us to increasingly partner with the Spirit and yield our hearts to the process he's conducting so that we might fulfill the original intent set out for us in Genesis 1. Now, I know we've covered a lot, but I also haven't addressed every concern or answered every question that arises from these verses. But from my standpoint, we've pretty much unpacked the clown car in a way that leaves us with one final question that I want us to consider here this morning. How is God's ultimate purpose playing out in your life? This is worth paying attention to. Simply put, are we becoming more and more like Christ? For so many years when I was younger, I considered the call to holiness as an optional part of the Christian faith. I treated salvation as a one-time get-out-of-hell-free card kind of thing that somehow meant that I could live life on my own terms and by my own whims, and that God was still somehow on the hook for my salvation because of a prayer I prayed that one time. Contrast that attitude with a friend who recently noted with humility and joy that she had been able to notice ways that she was growing in her own Christlikeness. As she joyfully gave credit to the Spirit's work in her life, she also was able to name ways that such changes have come through her own dedication to the journey of spiritual formation in partnership with the Spirit. Fam, this passage insists that, like my friend, each of us who is a sibling of Christ on account of his atoning death and triumphant resurrection should be able to see ways that we are becoming more like our older brother. So again, I ask, how is God's ultimate purpose playing out in your life? Are you, like my friend, able to identify ways that through partnership with his indwelling and empowering Spirit, you are becoming more like Jesus? Or are you more like my adolescent self, imagining that God owes you salvation because of a prayer you prayed once, and in spite of your refusal to participate in his ultimate purposes in your life? Or perhaps neither of those categories describes you today. Perhaps you have yet to ever embrace the truth that there is a good God who created you with intention, an intention bound up in Christ and accessed only by faith in his sacrifice as the sufficient payment for the ways that we have each participated in the rebellion that was launched in the garden. If that last category describes you, I urge you today, join the family of God. Turn your life over to the one who laid his down, not only to pay for sins, but to create a new family. If you don't know how to start that journey, or you don't know what the next step would be for you, I urge you, talk to someone about it. Could be the person sitting next to you. Could be one of our prayer teams. Could be someone on the pastoral staff. But don't leave here without discovering God's ultimate purpose for your life, to take your place in the redemptive story that God has written for his image bearers through his Son, the perfect image of God. I want to give us just a couple of moments in silence to consider what this passage and what this teaching might be calling us into today as we pay attention to what the Spirit's doing inside of us. So let's take some moments in silence. We tell a redemptive story week by week as we come to this table, and it is a story that is bigger than most of us typically imagine. When we take the bread and the cup, we recall and celebrate that the only perfect image bearer willingly laid down his sinless life to make atonement for our sinfulness and to turn rebels into siblings. If you have known that redemption in your own life, if you are a sibling of Christ by trust in his sacrificial death and triumphant resurrection, this meal is for you. As you approach the table, I encourage you, come in a spirit of gratitude and a spirit of rededication, ready to admit your ongoing need for grace and to submit anew to the partnering that the Spirit wants to do to conform you to the image of Christ. We'll have prayer teams on each side as well as in the back, ready to pray with you about these things or anything at all. But let's come to the table as we continue in our worship.